And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Carl M. from Los Angeles.
Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank Larry for asking me to come here. Since I've been sitting here, about four gentlemen have walked up to me and said, Larry said that they had to be there. And I said, me too. But I haven't met Larry yet. So he's the only one that didn't show up. So anyway. Anyway, I got to tell you, my sobriety date is January 21st, 1987. And making this trip down here tonight from the Los Angeles area, I get awash with memories because I left here 2 years sober in 1989 with everything I owned in a 1968 Volkswagen that had a hole in the floorboard that I had to push start. And I had this idea that if I stayed sober, I might be able to get a life. And I got to tell you that the very first thing that was told to me in Los Angeles to get a life was I needed to put newcomers in that car. And I argued at first, but the gentleman that told me that was 10 years sober when I was born, right? So I decided I'd try doing that. And I got to tell you, it worked. The very first night that I put new guys in that car, my life got better. The new guys could push start my car. He didn't say how much better, he just said better, right? So anyway, the most important thing I can tell you about Carl Morris is that he's alcoholic. I am an alcoholic. That is a center point of who I am. Like I said, I'm sober 29 years. I am 54 years old. I've been sober and active in Alcoholics Anonymous for significantly longer than half my life. And whether I was drinking or whether I've been sober, the fact that I'm an alcoholic has been the decision maker in my life. The reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. It's not very complicated. The reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is because I've got a really, really strange relationship with alcohol. That's it. I know. Whoa, surprise, right? And this strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. Now, I'm not going to be texting up here. I'm just going to be timing myself because it's kind of unfair. You have the clock. I don't, right? And so you guys are like ticking away, bing, 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 bing. So the first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A very strange thing happens when I drink booze. The book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says that the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink alcohol is what they call the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It's really bizarre. Happens with nothing else. An example of that is they were kind enough to give me this bottle of water, and over the next 40 minutes to 4 hours that I'm talking with you, you think I'm kidding. It took me 3 hours to get down here, for God's sake. I'm teasing. Over the next 40 minutes that I'm talking with you, I will probably drink half this bottle. I might finish it, but I can absolutely guarantee you that once I finish this bottle of water, I am not going to go get a case of water and lock myself in a motel room. Really, there's no chance of that happening. No chance at all. I'm not going to be calling you guys up later, dude, I need another case, come on, man. Right? Not going to happen. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this bizarre physical reaction that I get, if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, well then, just say no would have wiped out alcoholism, right? Early 80s, Nancy Reagan came out and said, just say no. I would have, and I imagine you would have gone, ha-ha, no. And just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. But I've got this other strange part of my relationship with alcohol. And that happens when I'm not drinking it. Of and by myself, if I don't drink for a day, a week, or a month, I seem to have this mind that is able to paint a picture that makes it okay to take another drink no matter what the pain, humiliation, and suffering was a day, a week, or a month ago. Am I doing all right, Heather? Good. Good. And it never seems to enter into the equation whether it was my pain and humiliation or your pain and humiliation. I could care less. Sooner or later, my mind is able to rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So I can't drink successfully because of this bizarre physical reaction that I get, but I cannot, of and by myself, not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. Because I swear to you, if I could do either one of those two things, I would. I'm going to harp on that physical feature a little bit more. Nice to see you again. She's been very kind to me up here in the front row. I'm going to harp on that physical feature a little bit more because it's the one thing, bar none, we all have in common. If you're new or fairly new, and you're trying to, been told to listen in meetings until you hear your story, it might be a while. Really, because Alcoholics Anonymous is a huge, wide cross-section of society. We are all here. Every form, every part, every race, creed, color, religion, background, education, no education, good families, bad families, you know, grew up over in another side of the world. We're all here. Right? Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place where the bank president, the bank teller, and the bank robber are all right here in the same room. Right? And they all have a very different perception of what just happened. So our stories will be different based upon our backgrounds, right? But we also drink and get loaded differently than each other, too. If you listen closely in meetings, you will find out that we drink differently than each other, too. An example of that, let's say right through these side doors, we wheeled in this giant cart right into the middle of the room. If my eye's twitching, I don't know what happened on my drive down here, but something got in my eye and I don't know what's happening. But anyway, so I'm not winking at you. That's right. Just going to let you know. Right, let's say we wheeled in this giant cart right into the middle of the room, and on that cart we had all the kinds of booze we all like, you know. If you're a top-shelf expensive drinker, we got it for you. Remy Martin, Courvoisier, okay, fine. You know, if you're a bottom-shelf drinker, we got that too. Mad Dog 2020. And, you know, anything you like. We got it all, everything in there. And if then we all went and took four or five stiff drinks, real drinks, no umbrellas in there, no mixer, a good four or five stiff drinks, we're all going to be acting very, very differently from each other, right? Over in this corner, we got the good time crowd. Ah, ha, 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 talk, talk, talk. Woohoo, talk, talk, talk. Good time, talk, talk. Add a little methamphetamine, talk a little faster. Talk, 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 right? Right? But we're having a good time over in this corner, right? Over in this corner, we'd have the sobbers. You know, the whoa, they get drunk and all they do is, wah. Over in this corner, we'd have the fighters. You know them, right? Right? If you're around them, you're going to jail tonight, right? Got to fight. Over in this corner, a bunch of us would be naked. I personally would be visiting each corner trying to find a couple of friends to come over here with me. Just the way I am. So our stories are different based upon what corner we're drinking in, too. Right over in the good time crowd, a lot of DUIs over there. Why? Because, hey, always out at the bars. Always got to get to the next bar after hours. Got to pick up the booze. We're going to Fred's house. Right? Out there driving. A lot of DUIs. Over in the sobbing corner, no DUIs. They don't even leave the damn house. It's just, locked in the closet. Right? Worst thing they do is call up inappropriate people at midnight. Or God forbid these days, drunk Facebooking. Isn't it funny when your newcomers in your group go out and do that and you're like, oh no. Right? Right? But no legal trouble in that corner. Over in the fighting corner, their stories always have attorneys, court dates, probation, parole. Right? Over in this corner, a bunch of children show up by surprise. Like, that'll change your life. Right? But no matter which corner we're in, there's one thing we would all be doing. There's one thing, no matter which corner we're in, we'd all be doing. We'd all be back at that cart for another drink. Right? And it was so important for me to learn that when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if I can listen in that vein, I can identify with anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous as to what happens to you when you drink and what happens to you on your own when you try not to drink. I set this relationship up with alcohol that I just described to you right from the get-go when I first started drinking. I started drinking much later than most people in AA. I was 11. It's pretty late. Pretty late. Grew up in Seattle. I'm just going to skip my childhood. This is it. This will sum up my childhood. My childhood, basically my vocabulary by the time I was 14 to the time I got sober, this is my vocabulary. Whoa. Wow. Whoa. Right? That's my vocabulary. I am just a wasted teenager, right? I am just loaded. My parents tried to fix things, get me out of public schools, into private schools. See, they blame my problems on people, place, and things. But I'm an alcoholic. All that happens when you change people, place, and things in my life is that I'm loaded with different people. In different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. My parents decided to send me to Washington State University to get me out of Seattle. I spent 3 years at that university on my parents' money, and I got, well, almost 10 credits. And at any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content, about a 0.25. By the time I'm 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish. My mother is like Icelandic. Therefore, I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. My parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter. They said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas. And as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. Another impressive year, I'm sure. They were impressive people with impressive lives. The next paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year. And that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves to golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. They were actually being very kind, to tell you the truth. Long story short, a really bad night happened. It would take till breakfast to describe everything involved in what I'm about to say, so I just cut to the chase. Really bad night happened. It was so bad that I joined the Navy. It was that. What I'm about to tell you should concern you, but on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAB test, and this test that I took qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you, that the United States Navy would have any type of system in place that would even maybe possibly or even remotely allow somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that particular test. That test is called a urinalysis test, is what it's called. Never knew how to study for those things, right? Should have been kicked out. A series of events kept me in the Navy anyway. A year and a half later, I'm a lower rank than when I first came in. What's happening to me at this point is that I'm 23, I'm 24, I'm 25 years old. And when I take a drink, I have no idea whether it's going to be 3 hours or 3 days. I'm starting to go on these three-day drunks that I have no idea how to start them or stop them. I don't know when they're coming. And I just know that every once in a while I'm coming out of these three-day drunks. And I got to tell you, it's a strange feeling coming out of one of those three-day drunks in a foreign country. 6 a.m. in the morning on a large pier going, there was a destroyer here the other day. Navy frowns on that behavior. Been in the Navy about 2 years, and I accidentally drove my car through the guard shack at the front of the naval base. I know. I was shocked, too. Believe me, the Navy was very angry that morning. The Marine was all right. They were patching me up for minor injuries. They're reading new charges on me, and this is nothing significant in my life. New charges, that's just what happens in a guy's life like mine, about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. But the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called Anabuse for me. I hear the groans. Yeah. I was now under orders to show up at sick bay every single morning before quarters, and the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure it actually ingested in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this illness we refer to as alcoholism, and that is I had no drugs or alcohol in my system, and I was literally going insane. See, what happens to me when you take alcohol away from me and you do not give me specifically the center of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I either need to have alcohol or I need the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. I cannot be on the fringes. I cannot be coming and going. I got to be in the center or I'm getting loaded. When you take alcohol away from me, which people have been doing for a number of years, whether they had authority over me or loved me or were able to plead with me and were, you know, in their own way trying to take alcohol away from me, they would always be pointing at my alcoholism as wrecked cars, lost jobs, flunking out of college, my physical health, all these things that are saying. And if I could have said this, I would have said, "Yes, I agree. The price for my drinking is getting high. I'm with you on that. I'm not happy the car's on fire either. You think I want to be here watching my car? But no, I don't." But if I had the ability to say this, I would have said, "But if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink." And I didn't understand I was defining alcoholism, that the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this thing called alcoholism is what happens to us when we try not to drink. It's the thing that the rest of the world does not understand, that they are astonished that we would drink again. And they see the outward stuff that, you know, everybody who drinks too much does, but they don't understand what's going on in here. I'm on this Anabuse, and I remember counting those days, just, and every day got darker. Just, it's been 4 days, and I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 6 days, and I'm on Anabuse. Now it's been 8 days. 6 hours and 15 minutes, and I'm on Anabuse. I started to look around that ship. The other men, they're talking behind my back, all 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. It's not an illusion. We're really doing it. On the 10th day, I just snapped. I went AWOL from my ship, locked myself in a little hotel room in downtown San Diego. This would have been May of 1986. Plaza Hotel, 4th and Broadway. I know. Still there. I check every couple of years. I take a little tour. In May of 1986, and for the rest of 1986, until I got sober, the Plaza Hotel cost $13 a night. They've upgraded that whole area, you know, the whole gas lamp area is all upgraded. Plaza Hotel is now $19 a night. There's a couple of rooms that are $21 a night now. I remember I locked myself in this little hotel room, and I had a bottle of vodka on this rickety little end table, and I had a little shot glass. And as I stared at the bottle of vodka, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of Anabuse. They had told me, "Son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this Anabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die." I remember looking at the bottle and I thought, "Well, wonder which reaction I'm going to get." I took one shot and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure. And I took another shot. All of a sudden I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room. I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat. Then all of a sudden I was like... hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. You guys are really sick if you think this is funny. I've got proof of that. You guys all look reasonably sane. You're dressed nicely. Most of you have taken a shower. But apparently you're not well if you're laughing at that. Here's my proof. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years. 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor and his sponsor were real sticklers about that ninth step. My Navy paycheck for my first 2 years of sobriety was, I didn't even get to see it. It was just out there trying to pay stuff off. I'm still push starting that same car I told you that I got sober in when I got out of the Navy. But one of the amends that I was unable to make was that my parents had paid for that bachelor's degree. Remember? I didn't have one. Apparently that was a problem with my sponsor and his sponsor. So they told me I had two choices. I either had to pay my parents back every single nickel they had wasted on that, or I had to go get what they had paid for in the first place. So that's how I wound up in the area of Los Angeles that I'm in. And I signed up to take this telecommunications business bachelor's program. And in the first couple of semesters, I had to take this business presentation class, like a speech class, you guessed it, for giving business presentations. In the first couple of days of this speech class, the instructor was randomly pointing at students one at a time, throwing them up in front of the room, would give them a topic to talk on, and each student was supposed to talk for like 3 or 4 minutes on whatever the instructor had told them. And after about 7 or 8 students were up there, he pointed at me, and I walked up to the front of the room, and from the back of the room, the instructor shouted out, "Talk about a bizarre situation in your life." So I told them about drinking on top of Anabuse. They did not respond the way you guys did. They were like, there were a couple of guys in the back going, "Woohoo, right on, dude, party!" Right. So anyway, I'm back in the hotel room. I'm red-faced. I'm hyperventilating. I'm sweating. And I took another shot. And up it came. My second sponsor, when I got up to L.A., a man named Eddie Cochran, literally one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. If he would have still been alive this last December, he would have had 65 years of sobriety. I know. His medallion, his widow gave me his medallion that he used to wear. Big medallion, said 1950. It hangs in my office right now. I value that a lot. Anyway, he used to call the next thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. This is a new level of puking I'm unfamiliar with, right? Because we all know normal puking, right? You get a little, we're out there in the middle of a good drunk, you get a little warning, right? A little sour taste in the back of your throat. Maybe a little bit comes up in your mouth and you kind of go, mm-hmm. And we all know, based upon experience, we have 30 to 60 seconds to try to find a bathroom if there happens to be one. If we're driving, we really try to get the window down because, you know, if it goes all over the dash, it's a real buzzkill. Especially if it gets into the ventilation system. It's really, oh, man. Plus, it's a total blow it when you get pulled over and there's puke all over the place, right? So we try. But we get the warning. But here on the Anabuse, no warning. Just, sort of this Linda Blair spray across the room. But thank God the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. It's a design feature, I believe. Maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. Found the magic of drinking on top of Anabuse, that if I would hang in there, and it's important, if you're going to drink on top of Anabuse, you do have to hang in there. You cannot half measure it. You got to really be committed. With me, if I would hang in there and keep drinking and keep puking and keep drinking and keep puking, about an hour, hour and a half, enough of the Anabuse would kick out of my system and I'd quit throwing up and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating. And I'm pretty much all right with that, right? So I drank on top of Anabuse the last 7 months of my drinking. My second and my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in National City. Last thing I remember is lots of fists were flying. They were not mine. I saw a lot of blood. It was mine. And next thing I knew is I came to on an operating table in Balboa Hospital. I got to tell you, you know when you come out of a blackout, and you are looking at your surroundings to see, you know, whether you recognize them or not. And you're trying to gauge good night, bad night. You know, you look next to you and, you know, gauge it based upon that. Or, you know, when you come to on an operating table, that is evidence of a very bad night. Right? My last night of drinking, being let out of the San Diego jail, being transferred from civilian authorities back to military authorities. I'm in handcuffs. They're extra tight that morning. Neck muscles aren't working well. There's lots of people in uniforms. They're angry. That morning, the officer deck put, when they tried to bring me back to my ship, put his arm up and said, wrong answer. Orders have already been processed on this loser. Orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, as I stood there in handcuffs, apparently some sort of option was thrown out on the table. And I don't remember perking up and going, oh, treatment sounds good. You know, God, I don't remember that. Nor do I remember thinking, and it would have been more likely that but I don't remember this either, but it would have been more likely I would have thought, hey, if I just act like I want that, maybe I can get out of this one too. I now know that it wouldn't have mattered what I was thinking or feeling that morning because I was in handcuffs. And I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but my experience in handcuffs was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs, never once did they ever turn to me and say, so what's your opinion on this matter? Right? When you're in handcuffs, you go where they say. And they took me up to the NARC, the Military Treatment Center, up at the Miramar Naval Air Station. I don't think it's there anymore. I think they've moved it. And I got to tell you, I wound up there, and I spent 45 days there. And I got to tell you, as far as I'm concerned, the military has one of the best treatment centers in the world. Not only for the normal reasons that they care about what they're doing there, but the second thing, the main thing why I believe that is because every night white vans would pull up into the parking lot and we would be taken out to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. They were not under any illusion that they had some sort of new cure for alcoholism. They knew that what they could do is give us medical attention, some whatever therapy they can do, but every night they would send us out in meetings to hear your message that might save our life. And I want to thank San Diego Alcoholics Anonymous for always allowing the military, and we always sit in the back, arms folded, right? But you guys just carry on anyway, whether we're there or not, and I knew that you were doing this whether we were there or not. You were not putting on any show for us. You were just doing what you do, and I could sense it. I remember my very first meeting. I'm sitting in the back of it was at the North Shore Alano Club. We're sitting in the back, and one guy, I mean, he just knocked me right out of my chair. I'm not the kind of guy that fought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the kind of guy that, apparently drinking on top of Anabuse for 7 months just was a little, got me to surrender a little bit, I guess, to think that maybe I need another answer. I don't know. But I'm sitting in the back, and I'll never forget this one guy. He got called on. He walked all the way to the front. He introduced himself. He said one sentence, and he sat down. This guy goes, my name's Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago. But it needed it for transportation. And he sat down. And I just, and I'm looking around like, did you hear that? And, you know, all of you guys are like, hey, Jack says it all the time. My second meeting, I remember I'm at a meeting, and I really was identifying with the way you guys told your stories and the way you talked about the way you felt in between drunks. But I wasn't hearing your solution quite yet. It was just bouncing off me, but I was identifying with the problem. But I remember my second meeting, I got really confused because everybody at that meeting was talking about something called a drug of choice. I don't hear it very much anymore, but back in the 80s, man, you just heard it. My drug of choice is, and somebody, well, my drug of choice is. And I'm sitting in the back going, oh, for Christ's sake, was I supposed to be choosing out there? Do they want me to choose now? What are they talking about? Next morning, I'm back at the treatment center. I asked this woman named Mary, who was our counselor. I go, Mary, last night in the meeting, they're talking about something called a drug of choice. What on earth do they mean by that? And she said, Carl, let's play a game. That kind of scared me, worried me, because what she was really saying is pay attention. And that was hard, and I didn't know why. I now know why it was hard to pay attention, because when I first showed up there, they do a medical checkup on you, and they found out that they told me my liver was a liver of a 70-year-old man. My pancreas was shutting down. I had extreme what they call alcoholic edema, where you can push your fingers into your skin and it just stays there and you can smell the booze out of it. Apparently, drinking on top of Anabuse for 7 months does a little number on your internal organs. Who knew, right? But when they find you in that kind of shape, they give you this little cup of pills, right? And the reason they give you this cup of pills is so that you don't throw the seizure in the middle of therapy and disturb everybody, scare everybody, sirens go off. It just ruins the day, right? So they give you this cup of pills. But if you've ever been on that cup of pillars, you know what I'm talking about. Your field of vision is just fine, about this middle aisle here. Just fine. See, fine. But there's dancing squiggly things over here. And when you turn to see what it is, now it's over here. Right? And then when you look over there, now it's over here. Right? So you're doing a lot of... Right? So you ever see the van pull up and they still got the bracelet on there and they're all going... That's what's going on, right? So Mary goes, this counselor goes, okay, Carl, pay attention. I go, okay. She goes, imagine I walk in this room, she said, and I have a tray. And on that tray, I got a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. If you're young and you don't remember what Thai sticks is, it was the chronic of the 80s, right? You guys call it purple Urkel or something now. Right? On the tray, she says, I got a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take? I started to drool immediately, right? I said, oh, I take them all. And she starts to snap her fingers. Settle down. Settle down, Carl. I'm like, right? You can't have them all. You can only have one. Which one would you take? She says, and I go, well, if I can only have one, Mary, I guess I'd take the ounce of cocaine. She said, oh, maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now? And I go, no. She goes, what's the problem? I said, well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, like, take that ounce of cocaine, I get the hell out of here, and I'd sell 2 8-balls. I would now have a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels. Now, the only reason I bring that up is to bring up a very important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new or fairly new, and that's sobriety date. You need one. I'm not kidding. You really need a sobriety date. If you get asked the question, what's your sobriety date, and you can't answer immediately, I'm afraid you might not have one. I don't care when or where you ask me, I can tell you January 21st, 1987. I don't have to go, And there's only one sobriety date. No matter what the guy outside the NA meeting told you. Oh, the funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety dates. When, around my home group, sometimes when I see a guy, I often go, hey, good to see you again. How long do you got? This guy goes, well... I had 90 days, but I drank last night, so now I have 89 days. I know, I almost had to call my sponsor. I think that kind of falls into the same category as being down in Mexico looking at the tequila, wondering, would that affect my U.S. sobriety date? Yes. Sobriety dates are international. Came out of that treatment center. The only thing I knew what to do was go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We got out on a Friday afternoon. And I wound up back at that North Shore Alano Club at the 6 o'clock gong show meeting. And I'm sitting in the back of this meeting, and the truth about my life is I'm 45 days without a drink. Got a lot of information. And I'm physically feeling better than I have felt since I've been a young teenager. But there had been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And what was even more dangerous than that is I did not know I needed one or what that was. If there's ever a turning point or a dangerous point in my life, it's right there. Now I've got information. I'm physically feeling better. I've been let out of a confined environment. Which way is my life going to go? One guy that night operating his primary purpose who decided, I'm sure there were many other men that were operating on their primary purpose that night, but this guy decided to lurk around the back of the meeting and he came up to me and said, hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing? It kind of scared me. Whoa, dude. I didn't think quick enough to lie to him because I swear to you, if I would have thought for one more second, I would have lied to him. I accidentally told him the truth. I go, I don't know. I just got out of a Navy treatment center earlier today. I don't know what I'm doing. This guy's eyes went bing, big smile went across his face. At the break, he's like fighting his friends off. He's mine. I got him. Mine. I didn't know you mark your newcomers around here, for God's sake. But there was something going on in this guy's life that particular Friday night that made him especially glad to meet me. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for one of his friends in his home group. Exactly. So he was wondering what he was going to do with his weekend, homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy was insane over this woman, flat out insane. In between this barrage of meetings he took me to, he'd throw me in the passenger side of his car, he'd start driving, and he'd start yelling. He wouldn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting, I guess. And he'd be yelling at me, you gotta go to meetings, you gotta read the book, you gotta get a sponsor, damn her! Gotta go to meetings, write her, damn her! And he's almost like spitting on me, like, damn! Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so very glad that that guy, that night, in his pain, was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and therefore understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. I am so glad that that guy, that night in his pain, was not at home underneath his covers, whining into his sponsor's answer machine, "Sponsor, where are you?" If you're under 25 years old, an answer machine is this box that used to sit on the counter, right? Completely separate from your phone. It was really weird. Really a strange device, right? So glad he wasn't yelling into his sponsor's answer machine, "Sponsor, where are you? Fix me! Give me a golden answer!" I'm so glad that obviously his sponsor had taught this guy the valuable lesson of, yes, as your sponsor, I will be glad to be here to try to give you a few answers when I can. But he had taught him that if you work with others, you will have a lifetime of solutions at your fingertips. And by going to so many meetings in the same area of town, I learned something really valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new. And what I learned, I'm going to correlate it to a football game. Now, a football team is out there on the field for one reason and one reason only, to win the game. And how do they win that game? They huddle up, they make a plan, and they do one play. And they huddle up again, they make another plan, and they do one play. That's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The game around here is one day without a drink, you're a big winner. And how do we do that one day? We run in here and we huddle up. And we go, remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Break! And we go out there and we try a little of this and we try a little of that. I got back to my ship after that weekend and the one other sober guy on my ship, thank God he was an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so glad the one other sober guy on my ship was not a guy who hadn't been to a meeting in 9 months or a year, didn't know what to do with me. This guy was waiting for me like I was gold being delivered to him on a silver platter. Right? He was just all over me. He became my first sponsor. He only had 14 months. He was no expert. He didn't even know what the hell he was doing. But his sponsor had told him that he needed to work with somebody else, and here I was. And I got to tell you, the next couple of years, when I look back at my life and my first 2 years of sobriety and with Bob W., that was his name, Robert Wokek. He passed away of cancer at 47 years old. He was still 14 months ahead of me, too, though. When I look back at the first 2 years of him and I gallivanting around up around the planet, literally, trying to find meetings and reading the book and stuff, it was Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. The blind leading the blind. Neither one of us knew what the experience we were looking for was, but we were going for it like our life depended on it, because it did. We used to read the big book in the middle of the Pacific Ocean down in the engine room in this little battery shop. We used to call it the USS Cushing DD-985 Underway Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was just him and I. And then the ship set up a court card system. Whenever people were getting in trouble on Liberty, they were sentenced to come down to listen to us. They're like, oh, man. And we'd read the book and, oh, God. As I told you, 2 years sober, got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. That's the result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, an apparently merciful God, and a personnelman that lost half my file. That's how that happened. I got to tell you, in the 29 years that I've been here with you people, I've stayed in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never wandered from the center. I get scared whenever I, you know. And the deal is, When I first met that man when I moved to L.A. that told me to start putting newcomers in my car, I had tried to explain to him, you know, I'm 2 years sober, man. I don't even have a place to live. I got everything I own in that Volkswagen. I got to go to school. I got to work. I'm going to be busy. I got to get a life. I've heard people talking about having a life in AA. I need one of those. And I'm going to be busy. You won't see me at meetings very much. When I get a life, I'll okay. And Eddie just laughed when I tried to tell him. He had this weird little laugh. And he said, oh, son, school and work, those are wonderful things to do in early sobriety or whenever in sobriety. Wonderful. But that's what we do in between meetings. And what he was really telling me is one of the secrets to long-term sobriety comfortably, and that is that he was telling me I need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world, instead of trying to hash it out there in the world and visiting Alcoholics Anonymous when convenient. Got to tell you, I have found meaning and purpose in my life that I did not even know was available for a guy like me. 17 years sober, I got married. We had two beautiful kids. Marriage did not work out. I know normally at this point when speakers are there, they go, oh, and you know, we've happy road of destiny, right? Wrong answer. Marriage did not work out, but man, you know what? We looked at each other after 6 months in the beginning of the divorce, and we fired our attorneys and said, you know what? We have to be co-parents here. We have to work together. We have no choice. We have no choice but to work together. And so, you know what? We split the house into two townhouses that are very close to each other, and those kids go back and forth, and we actually get along. We spent the whole day together at soccer games and lunch and stuff. And, you know, that's the result of Alcoholics Anonymous pointing out the reality that if you have children with somebody, you're going to be part of their life no matter what, so you better make sure it works out one way or another. And I got to tell you, those kids, they're 9 years old and 11 years old, Madison and Ryan. I got to tell you, I've never experienced this level of love in life. If you've got kids, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I don't need to tell you. If you don't have kids, I promise you, God does not hide this level of love from you either. You will find it in another way. But I got it from having kids. It's like I met who I would die for. I never felt that. I know when I raised my right hand for the Navy, I said I'd die for you. I really was hoping it was not going to come to that, right? But if your name was Tom, right? First speaker, Tom, gave a great, great talk. I love the guy. I really do. I love him as an alcoholic. I love him for what he's trying to do. But I got to tell you, if we're out at Starbucks later and some guy comes in wielding a gun saying, what did you got to go? I'd say, well, have you met my friend Tom? But if it was my kids, I would dive right in front of that bullet. I can't believe that level. I didn't know that I had that in me. And I would never trade my kids for the first drink. Never in a million years would I trade them for the first drink. But I'm alcoholic. I know what it means to be alcoholic. Although I would never trade them for the first drink, I would trade them for the second drink like that. So there is nothing that is more important than me staying in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous if I want to be a good dad. That's why I left this afternoon when I normally would have had my kids and I wasn't able to go to their cousin's birthday party and I had to give up a bunch of stuff to drive down here to talk to you folks. It's because I care about my sobriety. I care about my kids. And you know what? Life takes on this where I see the colors and hear the music of life when I'm in the center with you. So I find it a privilege when you guys ask me to come down and talk with you. And I hope I still have another 25 years of the Center of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.